Blog Talk Radio.
Your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie ahead, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this astounding future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, just pumped. You know, I have to say about our intro, it always is, it's so optimistic and upbeat. It's just, you know, it's a good time to be alive. You know, I mean, we're always
we're seeing
things happen so quickly, and I mean, it's just it's fun to be a part of, isn't it?
It really is. That's why we do it.
Yeah.
You know, that's why we're that's why we're here every week talking about this stuff. And I gave it a kind of a tongue in cheek title tonight about robots that won't kill us. But not only will they not kill us, they'll do a lot for us. And we've got a number of other topics that touch on major changes in what life is all about, or how life works, or what we can do day to day, or what we can expect over the horizon, that are all underway. And this is a fun kind of a show to do, because tonight is just one of our kind of grab bag shows. Basically, it's not even a grab bag. Basically, the way this works is, Stephen, you send me a bunch of topics, and I say, okay, that looks like a show to me.
We'll, let's talk about that.
Yeah, and we'll do a show. I don't think I contributed anything to this list.
That is okay, but and this stuff is loosely tied together in that it's stuff we find interesting. I mean, and generally has sort of a futuristic bent to it. So I guess that's what we're looking at tonight. And these grab bag shows turn out to be our most fun shows sometimes. And so
a lot of times they're the most fun to do. I mean, it's really fun when we have a guest on and we're having fun with the guest. But without a guest, this is the most fun you can have, I think, on this show, is when we just start randomly working from topic to topic. So we got several of them, and I think we should just jump right in and talk about these robots that aren't going to kill us. This is actually it's a piece that was, I'm trying to remember where it was. It was on, actually, it was on Google. In a site called IHS Engineering 360, and they were talking about, or Google had brought this up, maybe it was archived or something, but basically talking about smoothing the relationship between robots and humans, making robots more human compatible, making it such that humans and robots are going to be able to work together better. And, you know, when you look at that, you go, well, what's the issue now? Right? What are the big barriers to people and robots doing things now?
Well, you know, people are soft and robots are hard. And if a robot move, and we're limited in our strength. I mean, we generally there's a certain range that you can expect a person's strength to fall within. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way for a robot. A robot could be extremely strong and made out of metal, and if it moves the wrong way, you know, take someone's head off, literally. And so, I mean, that's you know, something to be concerned about, like on a factory floor or things like that. That, you know, how does a robot that is flexible enough to do things like a human being, how do they work around human beings without injuring someone? Because, you know, right, you know, mostly robots have been, you know, doing one thing, you know, tightening this bolt, painting this swath in this direction on the car that comes down the line, and nothing else. But you know, looking to the future, you're looking at robots that can be a lot more flexible, like a line worker, working side by side with line workers, and so that's the key, is making them so that they can work with people without hurting people, and that's kind of an engineering challenge.
Yeah, I mean, especially in the industrial context, where robots have been doing, I mean, one of the reasons that robots were brought into play, let's face it, was to replace people. But another reason was they're more durable and they're stronger than people. You know, you can have
right.
a robot arm doing something that a human arm could never do, right? And it never gets
right.
tired, right? It just keeps on doing it, and it does it right every time, too. So there was a lot of appeal for that level of robotics back in the 80s and 90s, and even to today, there's still a lot of appeal for that kind of automation. But we're seeing a movement towards people and robots working more closely together. And if we're going to be hanging out together, we've got to be able to be safe around robots. So that's a big piece of it. Let's get robots that aren't going to accidentally, you know, it's not a fear of killer robots so much. It's not a fear of like a robot that goes nuts and wants to hurt somebody. It's a fear of we didn't think of this, right? It's
right.
a fear of here's an interaction going on between a human and a robot, and we didn't think of this scenario. We didn't think of this way that a person could get between a robot and what they're trying to do, or the robot doesn't see your head, or you know, whatever the
appendage we're
I'm
talking
sorry, go
about.
Ahead, do it. Yeah, whatever the unfortunate circumstance might be.
Yeah. You know, and what we're talking about basically is engineering the three laws into these robots, right? I mean, and typically the critics of the three laws of Asimov's three laws of robotics have been that, well, you know, that's not the way it works. You know, you don't, it's, you know, it's not a software kind of thing. That you're just teaching the robot's ethics. Well, that, you know, in a way, you're not doing. Of course, you're not doing it that way. You're doing it. You're basically sometimes you're building it into the hardware. It could be something as simple as a physical barrier, like a chain link fence, that you know, the gate has to be closed on before the robot can operate. You know, it keeps robots separate from people, and it can just, you know, it can swing wildly and do all kinds of crazy things that would be very dangerous if there's, and it just will not turn on at all until that gate is closed. And
right,
you know, is that, you know, is that the three laws? In a way, kind of it is, isn't it? I mean, that's it's built into its design not to hurt people, and
that certainly goes to the goals of the three laws. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So. In some ways, that's what we're talking about. But as robots become more sophisticated, you know, you got to move past things like that and actually, in a way, build the ethics into the software instead of these hardware solutions that we've had in the past. So
right,
it's and that's what they're addressing in this April 7 article. How that is a challenge in there, and they're making some advances in that area.
Yeah, I mean, we're still at a stage where we're ethical robots, right? There are
right.
no robots right now that are making moral decisions or that need to be told right from wrong. They will just do whatever you tell them to do. And right now, you got to be real careful what you tell them to do, because if you're not thinking about the potential unintended, unforeseen consequences of what they've been told to do, it can lead in a bad direction. But it's important. It's important these ergonomic issues get worked out. Ultimately, this is a safety and ergonomics issue, as it says in the article, because people and robots are going to be working more closely together, or people are going to be encountering robots in new scenarios. And one that they mention in this article is health, and we've talked about this quite a bit. I think it's very likely that. There will be, I mean, we've talked about prototypes for drone ambulances. Well, those are going to have a robotic component to them for sure. Ultimately,
right.
there may even be, you know, full-blown drone doctors or you know, robot doctors performing surgery and that kind of thing. And by the time we get to that point, you're going to have a whole new generation of sophistication around the kind of not only safety precautions put in place, but the kinds of things you have to be cautious about, right? Because you're having so many more different kinds of interactions, and there's so many more potential ways that it can go wrong. But it's an important thing to overcome, because we do see this future where robots are very much a part of our everyday lives. We'll have them in our homes. They'll be driving us around. They will be doing our jobs for us, basically, or if not for us, taking them from us. I mean, I think it's very reasonable to assume that robots are going to play a much bigger part in our lives in the near future than they currently do. And the idea that we're, I think, trying at least to get a little bit ahead of the curve here, to try to anticipate, what needs to happen to make that interaction as safe as possible. Because you have to get it safe before you can work on the other things, right? It's like,
right,
if you've got a robot where everything is really pleasant, but then one day he accidentally breaks your arm, no good. That's just, you don't care about the witty repartee that you guys had at that point, right? It's like, you've got to handle the safety issue first, and then the rest of it can come. And if we're going to be collaborating
I would say, Phil, that it's very similar to the autonomous car issue.
It's the same issue, really. Yeah.
It's the same exact issue in just a different place. It's in your home or in the factories or in the workplaces instead of on the road, but it's the same exact issue. You don't have to have 100% safety reliable robot for it to be more safe than a human being. A human being can break your arm in the workplace too. And
true.
So, the question is, it's, if I've got a robot that can that is more productive than a human being and is safer than a human being, it's still possible to break an arm or two every now and then.
Right.
But it's but actually, if you look at the numbers, it's breaking fewer arms. Then maybe that's what we need to do, and that's the direction we need to go in. I suspect that will be the way it's looked at. We will not require 100% safety of these robots in order to implement them. And of course, then as they're implemented, they will be improved upon, and become even safer still. But I think we will require that they be at least as safe as the humans they're replacing.
I think we'll insist that they be a bit safer. That they, and
right.
some will want them to be quite a bit safer. The standard of perfection will be held up. But I think we have to work past that, because it's not fair. It's not reasonable to hold up the standard of perfection. And as you said, as long as they're safer than humans, you're better off. You're better
right.
off. As long as a robot is less likely to hurt you than a human, you're better off working with a robot. However, if you are the unlucky individual whose arm gets broken by a robot in the workplace, you're going to have a very skewed perspective of the whole thing, I'm sure.
I'm sure that.
Yeah.
That was the subplot, I guess, of iRobot with Will Smith, wasn't it? He had a skewed perspective about robots because of an experience he had, where he was actually saved by a robot, but the child that was in the car next to him was not. And the
right.
robot made a calculation that, well, I can save, I can save this man,
right.
and the chances of saving the girl are much less. And
right.
And so it made the cold calculation, and he had a hard time living with that. So I think there are going to be stories like that. We're going to see things like that happen in the future, where we as human beings would have made a different decision than the cold calculating robots that
we'll try
in some
to
ways
save
may,
the kid. We will try to
yeah.
save the kid, even if that means two people die rather than one person lives, right? I mean, because in the moment you wouldn't think about it that way, right? That's the thing.
That's right.
This is, in a sense, the advantage that a robot has over us. Things like that are going to cause some friction in the future because
imagine
it is a very alien way of thinking.
Imagine if you'd had on 9/11, if you'd had robots working side by side with the,
right.
They might have blocked off the building and not allowed any humans to enter, knowing that
right.
the structure is not structurally sound.
Right.
You know? And it would have saved firefighters, right? But, you know, at the same time, we would have been thinking, you know what, they could have saved a lot of people, too, had they been allowed to enter.
Right. Exactly.
And so, and I think that's the sort of things, you know, that's the sort of ethical conundrums we will experience as we get, you know, as we see these robots, you know, join us. So it's
interesting
times.
In the end, having their perspective might help us make better decisions. It might. I think there's a lot of room for, as we've noted here, friction and misunderstanding, and I think there will be people similar to the Will Smith character in that movie. I forgot about that. Yeah, I think there will be people who will be totally repelled by that approach, or will see its effects and feel that way. But in the long run, I think, you know, we'll learn something from the robots, and ultimately, data-like, they might learn something from us too. It's interesting times ahead. I look forward to. I don't know if I welcome our robot overlords for one, but I do look forward to working more closely with them and not having my arm broken. I think that
good things.
I think that's important. All right, here's something else to look forward to. That is the rediscovery of, and the quote, the title here of the article that we've linked in the show description is "The Lost Material That Could Have Saved the World." And I want to tell you, Stephen, this is one of those stories that if I saw a movie about it, I would assume I was watching a science fiction movie. Okay? This is a true story
that sounds made up. Let me qualify this just a little bit. Our source here is a website called Mysterious Universe. And like you say, the story is almost too fantastical almost to be 100% believed. And it might be a slight exaggeration of what is actually true. Okay?
Okay, here's what I've verified by going to the world's most reliable source of information after reading this story. Because I was, you know, I was feeling the same way. So I went to Wikipedia, all right, and looked up Starlink, since, you know, Yeah, exactly. I believe in getting to the source, okay? So I looked in Wikipedia, and yes, they use more guarded language in talking about this, but the TV show that is referenced definitely happened, and the demonstration that he made of it, that definitely occurred, okay?
Yeah.
And the controversy about what happened to the stuff, can we get our hands on it, is real. So having said that, yes, disclaimers apply. We did read it off a Goopy site, but apparently there's something to it. An amateur chemist, a British chemist by the name of Maurice Ward, back in the, I guess it was the 80s, was upset by the news of an airplane crash, a crash that occurred when the interior of the plane caught on fire, and, you know, a lot of people were, everyone, I guess, would have died anyway in the crash, but people died from exposure to flame. They died from inhaling smoke. And he put his mind to, how could you make a nice, light, flame-proof, fireproof, heat-proof interior for airplanes? So this guy is a strict amateur. Using a blender and stuff that he could find, he starts experimenting with different compounds. And over a course of, what's that, Stephen?
It's plastics mostly, organic biopolymers or something. What do they call that? It's what do they call it? It's organic polymers and copolymers.
Polymers and copolymers, which it turns out I believe make up 80% of the stuff that he invented. He ends up inventing something that either his daughter or granddaughter named Starlight. And this is a remarkable material that Maurice Ward invented. I guess he made an appearance on a TV show on the BBC in 1993 called Tomorrow's World, where they took an egg and they coated it in this material that he had come up with, coated it in this starlight, and then they just took a blowtorch to it, okay, and they just blasted away on this egg. with the blowtorch, went about 5 minutes, you know, full bore blowtorch on the egg, and then it was fine. There were no scorch marks on the egg. It was not hot to the touch, and when they cracked it, it was a completely raw egg. It hadn't even cooked. Okay, so this stuff was remarkable, according to the story, and I haven't. I can't recall whether Wikipedia gets into this or not, but according to the story, the material was subsequently investigated in government facilities and subjected to even much more stringent tests, and proved just as durable, just as heat resistant, just as fire resistant. I think they subjected it not to a nuclear blast, but something approaching a nuclear blast, and once again, it was undamaged, and appeared that it would have provided the same kind of protection that it provided to the egg under those kinds of circumstances. So here was an amazing, you know, almost miracle substance that this guy invents basically in his kitchen, okay? And the question then is, why aren't we all enjoying it today, right? Why aren't our houses all painted with this? Why isn't it on the interior of cars, on the interior of airplanes? And sadly, the reason is, Maurice Ward could never come to terms with going into business with anyone over it. He had the idea that he should own 51% of it, and apparently he was very suspicious of government entities, of defense. He didn't want to see it used to hurt people, which, although it has these tremendous defensive qualities, you can see where it could be applied the other way around as well. And in the end, he died. Without having partnered with anyone. He died having shortly before he died saying that his family knew how to make the stuff, but since he passed, there seems to be no evidence that his family does know how to make the stuff. So it's entirely possible that the formula for this, the secret for how to make this, what would be immensely valuable material, died with its creator.
Yeah. And which seems awfully sad, but... You know, as you hinted at the beginning of this, Bill, things like this that are either it's a hoax, complete hoax, or it's something that eventually will be either reverse engineered or rediscovered.
Yes.
You know, it's one of those things that you know, we may not have at the moment, but you know, give it a little time. There's an idea I have about history called the adjacent possible, which means that anything that's discovered is upon what has come before. And if, you know, one inventor, you know, doesn't happen to get it today, then, you know, history kind of picks up and puts it in the hands of someone else. And to be invented by that other person, I think that idea, there's some basis for believing that's the case. And so I, although it's a little bit sad, I would say that the Starlight is, it'll reappear at some point if it's a real thing. It'll reappear at some point, maybe with a different name. But although Starlight's pretty cool, isn't it?
That was a pretty cool name. His daughter or granddaughter, whichever it was, came up with a great name for it. It's, you know, it's too bad they didn't go to market with such a good name, really. but I agree with you. We don't know if it's lost. He made samples of it. I can't imagine they've been destroyed. I don't know how you would destroy this stuff, frankly. I mean, that's probably some chemical you can put it in and solve, but it's not like you're going to set it on fire or anything. You could bury it and hide it, I guess. But assuming there are samples left, it could be reverse engineered. You know, you put the right chemists to work on it. You put the right lab to work on it, and they'll figure it out. Also, knowing just the partial scraps we know, anyone who sets out to try to discover it, again, assuming there's really something here, is farther along than Maurice Ward was when he started. So, I feel that it's just a matter of time before this is rediscovered. But the other thing that this tells me, a discovery like this, again, we're assuming he really did discover something or invent something, is that the potential for this kind of thing to happen has been largely untapped in our history. And we're actually entering a period, talk about exciting stuff that's happening, we're actually entering a period where it's going to be a lot easier to do this kind of thing. where people will, you know, you don't have to be an eccentric with a blender and a love of chemistry. I mean, you know, those are all good things to be, and it's great to have a blender, obviously. But you know, we've got 3D printers now. We talked just a couple weeks ago about a 3D printer that works at the molecular level. The ability to combine and recombine materials is undergoing a tremendous evolution. It is transforming as we speak. And it's becoming an information technology, which means that it becomes much easier to do, and which also means that it's a capability that soon gets passed into many, many, many more hands than had a role in it before. All of which is great, assuming that there's randomly things like this that can be found out there. And I have a feeling there probably are, that that starlight is not the one lone thing that was waiting to be discovered, but rather that there's a lot of stuff like this out there that's waiting to be discovered. And we're probably a few years shy of a period of almost unimaginable discovery just by regular people who will have access to this equipment, and it becomes a hobby.
Yeah, if you can put in the hands of just, you know, regular people, probably very smart regular people, but you know, some of these molecular printers that can lay down atoms. Think of all the you know, exotic super materials that could come of that, and that, you know, just don't occur in nature, but that could be discovered just by tinkering. And you know, the, obviously, the tools like that, much more sophisticated than a blender. And you know, and just kind of, he kind of did the, what he did was kind of by accident. Although I think he had an idea of what he was doing, because he was laying down, you know, different layers that he knew to be good barriers. And so I think that was part of what he was doing there. But imagine what could be done when you're working at the molecular level instead of, you know, in the macro level like he was. Exciting times.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think big stuff, big stuff coming, and very dangerous stuff coming too, because when you put that kind of that kind of capability out there, and it gets into more and more hands. Once again, we evoke Eliezer Yudkowsky's Moore's Law for Mad Scientists. It's not just happy, beneficial things that people will discover.
Yeah, the Moore's Law for Mad Scientists states that every 18 months, the IQ necessary to destroy the world goes down by a certain percentage, a certain amount.
Yeah, it goes down by a point or something like that.
Yeah, or something like that. So, that's not cool. So, obviously, we need to develop our defenses simultaneously with the. With the mad scientist problem, we need to be ready for that. So, anyway, that's cool stuff.
I think so too, and I look forward to seeing this process ultimately get automated. Talk about collaborating with the robots. What happens when automated labs just go to work on trying various things? A robot has even greater patience than, say, someone like Thomas Edison did, right? In trying out different different variations on something, in exploring how to make something happen. So this could apply not just to the discovery of materials, but to the invention of new kinds of machinery, to the development of new kinds of drugs. The idea of people random, you know, it's the monkeys on a typewriter typing out Shakespeare, right? We're getting a lot more monkeys and a lot more typewriters, I guess. You know, Hamlet is imminent here for us, or maybe even a Shakespeare play we never read. I don't know. I'm torturing the metaphor, but it speaks to the fact that although we feel like the great age of invention is behind us, that the great age of discovery where it comes to things like chemistry is behind us. In fact, that all may lie ahead, and it may lie ahead in the very near future. And it's going to be really interesting to see how that unfolds.
Yep. I guess we should tell that story about Edison real quick since you brought it up. You know, Edison was asked, how do you deal with the failure? You know, you you know, you've got 200 failures now trying to come up with the material to, you know, the proper material for the wick inside of a light bulb. And, you know, how do you even deal with that and keep going? And Edison's response was, it's not failure. I've just discovered 200 ways not to make a light bulb.
Exactly.
I love that story. Right. And, you know, you could with the right software, you could engineer that attitude into a invention machine, could you? So,
that's right.
That's
the next light bulb we use, or one down the road that we end up using. Some machine may have discovered 20,000 or 50,000 ways not to do it before we get to the one that really works for us. And you multiply that by virtually everything we own. And, yeah, I think we're going to have some neat stuff. Just put it that way. I think neat
I
stuff
agree.
Coming our way. All right, Stephen, what else we got this evening?
Okay, let's see here. Why would we be interested in going to Europa, Bill? NASA has received approval for its long-term budget, and they're excited because part of it is probes to Europa, and they explain this IO9 article explains why they're excited about it, and I guess we should too. Explain why.
I'm sorry, Stephen, you dropped out on me just at a critical moment there. Which story were we talking about?
We are talking about going to Europa.
Going to Europa. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, and NASA now has it as part of their long-range plans now. They've got it built into their budget to send probes to Europa. And the question is, why are they so excited to do so? And it's simple. Europa is, maybe one-tenth the size of Earth, but has twice as much water as Earth.
Right.
And which is incredible, isn't it? There's just so much water in it that much of it's liquid. You'd have to get through about a couple hundred yards of ice at the surface. They want to do with the probe is to literally melt their way through to the liquid water and then look around and see what's going on there. Neil deGrasse Tyson said, I'd be interested in putting the fishing pole in there and seeing what bites. And that's kind of what they're doing with this probe. And so that's kind of a neat thing.
Absolutely. Well, when you look at everyone should check out the IO9 article for the picture, if nothing else, because it shows the moon next to the Earth, and you go, wow, is really the moon that much smaller than the Earth? I guess it is. And then it shows Europa up against the moon, and it shows Europa up against Earth. And, yeah, it sits there. It takes up a nice little piece of North America, but there's plenty of North America left over around Europa. And you look at it, and you go, well, wait a minute, that little dot is actually more water than we have on Earth. And it makes you realize how thin the bubble is, right? The atmosphere down to the oceans, down to the surface that surrounds our planet. Because that doesn't look like enough water to cover the planet the way we think of the planet as being covered. You know, we think, well, the oceans are vast and deep. And actually, from that scale, from that perspective, I've heard that if the Earth were shrunk down to the size of a marble, it would be smoother than any marble you've ever touched, right? That actually you would not be able to feel the indentions where the, you know, canyons are, or the mountains or any of that kind of stuff. At that scale, it resolves away to perfectly smooth. Even so, we think we got a lot of water on this planet. Well, here's this tiny little ball floating out in space. Is it anything but water? Is it just a big ball of water, or do they even know?
They know, and there is a there is a hard center to it, it's funny. My kids were talking about it. They said, "Well, it's, according to this, it's a lot of it's metallic," and my kids are, one kid suggested, "Well, wouldn't that just mean that you'd end up with nothing but rust?" You know, and the other one said, "Hey, you have to have oxygen to have rust, dummy." You know, they're arguing back and forth. It was a funny conversation, and so But anyway,
well,
I'm
glad
there
people
is a
are
hard
thinking through the practical practical implications here. Absolutely, yeah.
That's right.
But it is exciting, is it? That much water together that there's liquid water. The idea here is you land something on Europa, and you would have to drill down. They're saying a long way, right? Or melt through.
Yeah, a couple hundred yards. Yeah, a couple hundred yards of ice that you'd have to go that deep. So either drilling or melting, and I think they're talking melting right now.
Yeah, and you know, on Earth, getting through a couple hundred yards of ice, not that big a deal. I mean, it is, but it's doable. You can make that happen. A little bit harder to do that out in the Europa neighborhood, right? To send the equipment to do that, and then on that spacecraft, still have like a little submarine you can send down. But if they figure out a way to do it, it'll be awesome because we'll have
the thing I would be worried about. The thing I'd be worried about if I were their engineers. Okay, we spend billions. We get a probe there. We drill through the ice. And then a geyser shoots it out into space and your probe is done. I mean, that's it. You know, because it's under pressure when you hit that water. That would kind of suck, wouldn't it?
Surely they would have thought of that, right?
I'm hopeful.
Heads up, NASA guys. Steven just gave you a big spoiler warning for how this thing could go wrong. Okay, so let's not make that mistake.
Murphy
all right?
Just threw in his two cents. Okay, yeah, so
I mean, it would be kind of cool looking, but yeah, it'd be such a loss.
Yep. So anyway, yeah. It's
but
exciting.
And if we could do that, because we know how to get around. Water is familiar, right? And there are other planets that have ultimately liquid surfaces. Jupiter, if you go down far enough, it's liquid. Something ammonia or something like that, and several of the planets have that. They have oceans. We could explore them too, but this would be a good starting place for doing something like that. You know, it's less gravity and it's water, which we're familiar with. And if we could make that happen, I think it opens up the door for all kinds of really exciting exploration in the solar system. Also, the possibility that we send a submarine down under all that ice. Swimming around, shining its light, taking pictures, and there's something else swimming around down there. Boy, wouldn't that be something, huh?
That would be great. So exciting times. So yeah, that's.
But then eats the sub, right? It just totally swallows the sub, and that's the end of it.
Yeah, I saw a. I wish I could remember the title of that. It was a sort of a downer science fiction program. Showing a manned expedition to Europa and how they got through the ice. And, they had so many things going wrong. By the end, they knew it was going to be a one-way trip kind of deal. And
right.
I don't want to give away too many spoiler alerts, but, it was a fascinating show. And,
what's the name of the show?
I wish I could remember. I'll tell you what. I will find out and we'll definitely have to mention it in next week's show. So.
Okay, all right. We can put it up in the show notes as well. So there you go. Actually, we should just mention it on the show so people have to listen 2 weeks in a row. I think that helps get you into the habit of listening, folks. If we give you these little incentives like that. But speaking of space. Interesting stuff going on in space. I think this
Europa Report. Okay, that's the name of the movie.
It was a movie called Europa Report. Okay, I'm going to check that
out. That's
right. Is it on Netflix?
Yeah, definitely. Looks like it might be. Check it out. See if it's on Netflix.
All right, I'm going to take a look. Speaking of space, this Europa thing isn't the only development occurring in space. This is kind of interesting. We've talked about this on and off over the years because originally there were going to be multiple private players in space. It wasn't just going to be SpaceX. There were other people talking about doing it. And now it looks like some of those other ones, although they've been a little bit slower to make any big splashes, are starting to show up. And in particular, the headline here was Jeff Bezos' rocket company to begin suborbital test flights this year. So Blue Horizon, Jeff Bezos, obviously founder of Amazon, His company is going to start doing something, a program that looks fairly similar to what Virgin Galactic is doing. Does that seem like a fair description?
Well, I'm just looking at the Arctic's conception of a space vehicle, Blue Origin's space vehicle, and it's more like a capsule, which would give it something in common with, I guess, SpaceX. They're going with a capsule model too. Now, Virgin Galactic is going with like a space plane that does suborbital flights as a space plane for tourists.
Right.
This is going to be a suborbital flights test flights. But I don't think that that necessarily this is being done just for tourists or anything. I think this is just the first step to orbital flights for Jeff Bezos' company. So.
Oh, okay. That's the part I missed. When I saw suborbital, I thought they were doing a space tourism kind of service. But you're saying that no, they're just that's just a step in the direction of where they want to go.
Exactly. I don't think they want to do the tourist model. They're kind of leaving that to Virgin Galactic. I think it's just a first step. And I believe SpaceX may have done that too. Done a suborbital flight or two before ramping up. Of course, NASA itself back in the 50s did that too, didn't they?
Yep.
With the Mercury program, did a few of those before. I think it was John Glenn was the first American to orbit, and but he was not the first American in space.
Alan Shepard, first American in space. He was our answer to Yuri Gagarin, but Gagarin was, the Russians went full bore. They went straight into orbit, so we were always we were always playing catch up. But we took that intermediate step that the Russians didn't take, and it looks like that intermediate step is proving to be kind of an important stage for people entering the commercial space market. It looks like that's where you go first before you move into space. So that's interesting. If they're going to be pursuing maybe some of the more, I don't know what the right word for it is, industrial, serious, commercial applications of space rather than the tourist market, I think that's probably a good thing. I'm all for Virgin Galactic. I think the idea of people buying tickets and going into space is a great idea. And originally, wasn't Virgin Galactic using a SpaceX ship, or was it not? Am I confused?
I think Virgin Galactic was always, Spaceship One was what they won the X Prize with, right?
Oh, that's right, Spaceship One. I'm sorry, I got SpaceX.
And it was a space plane. Now Spaceship Two is much bigger because it's built to take a number of passengers. Spaceship
right.
One was basically just going to be for that one pilot, and so it's much smaller. I remember thinking to myself how small it was. We're used to seeing things like a space shuttle, and I got up close and personal with the space shuttle when it was in New Orleans. I was able to get right up next to it, and it's still a remarkably big craft. I was thinking it was relatively small because it could fly on top of a 747, but no, it's still quite big.
Right.
Spaceship One was hooked it up to a standard pickup truck that had no trouble moving that little spacecraft off the runway after the flight. I remember thinking how small that was. And Spaceship Two is just a little bit bigger than that, so it can take a few passengers. So.
Just a bit bigger. So
just a bit bigger.
All that's to say, there are several things occurring in space. That's cool. You got SpaceX doing what they're doing. You've got Virgin Galactic doing what they're doing. Now you got Blue Horizon coming on, and there are some others that are mentioned in this article. And I think it's important that there be multiple players in this field. And there's a couple of reasons why. The first reason is I think competition is good. We were just talking about the U.S. and Soviet space race. Most of the really big accomplishments that have occurred in space occurred because of that competition. Really helped move things along. And even Spaceship One was part of a competition. So
right.
A different kind, but but it helps. And I think having multiple entities trying for the same goals or similar goals spurs them along. It creates urgency that they might not otherwise feel. So I think competition is good. And the other thing that's good about having multiple players is the possibility of specialization. That you can have Virgin Galactic say, well, we're going to be the consumer space market, right? We're going to be the space tourism market. And you can have SpaceX say, well, we're going to be the guys who support deep space. We're going to go to the asteroids. And Blue Horizon might take a somewhat different stance. You know, they might slice off another piece of it. But the more of those niches that get supported, the more of them that are possible. And the closer we get to real passenger travel into space, because you've got somebody specializing in that, or the closer we actually get to having the asteroids mined or to there being settlements on Mars or any of those things happening, because you've got multiple viable players pursuing their interests, and you've got one or maybe even one or two that are interested in that particular area. So I think it's all goodness. I hope just as we were talking about, you know, different missions to Mars, I think are a good idea that different people are talking about going. If there's more activity, it spurs those who are already doing something. I think it helps push them along, and it helps them to get more specific and to get more honed about what it is they want to do. So I'm pleased to see this new player, and I hope we see many more.
And I hope any and all of these companies work on the Starlight problem, right? I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. If they could use it.
One of them, yeah, they really could. Imagine a heat shield that is twice as effective at half the weight. You know,
right?
That's potentially what Starlight could be for a space program. So, yeah, I hope those guys they get on that. Exotic materials like that would be a big help, I'm sure.
Absolutely. All right, what's left, Stephen? We got time for one or two more of these.
Yeah, let's talk about something we talked about. Now, we first mentioned this subject that we're about to bring up back on Fast Forward Radio. A little while back, we mentioned this, and we mentioned it and said, yeah, this is a great idea. I hope they push forward with it. And I think you and I both still predicted that, hey, you know, people are laughing about how expensive this is, but they won't laugh forever. And what we were talking about, of course, is lab grown hamburger. Okay.
Right.
So basically they came up with, okay, here's how we do it. We synthesize, you know, we take stem cells from the muscle of a cow, and we figured out how to make those stem cells grow and become basically ground chuck, okay? And so I said, well, how much, you know, some reporter, well, how much did this hamburger cost? You know, and they, you know, they're, it apparently was tasty and everything. And they said, well, you know, $325,000 is about what this hamburger cost. And, of course, that was the headline, you know. Scientists
right.
invent $325,000 hamburger that doesn't require a cow. And that should not have been the headline. The headline should have been, you know,
it's a burger that tastes good, because efforts to do that before had produced really disgusting looking gray glop, right? That didn't look like a hamburger
tumor,
at all.
You know, I mean, here's your hamburger, tumor on a bun. You know, that's basically what they had managed to come up with before. But here they actually came up with something that was very, you know, indistinguishable from what you get from a cow. Does not require the death of an animal, and you know, Phil, I've never been even tempted to become a vegan or anything, but I'm going to tell you that if that is offered to me as an option, where, you know, Stephen, you can have all the hamburgers you want, and it doesn't require suffering by a feedlot cow, and then their ultimate. You don't have to have a bleeding heart to say, you know what? Absolutely, I want to give me the bloodless burger that tastes just as good. And so the question then becomes one of cost. Can we afford to do it? And
right.
so that's the news.
When you look at how far they've come from $325,000 down to $11, you know, $11, you can pay more than that for a burger at a nice hotel. So,
right.
You know, they're already closing in on making it affordable. And then there are other advantages. I think the humanitarian aspect of it is huge and will become even more important as vat-grown meat is able to replicate more of meat, you know, more than just hamburger. But there's also other considerations as well. There's environmental considerations. There's the fact that it ultimately takes a lot less energy to produce this kind of meat than it does to produce meat by, you know, it's a pretty inefficient process, right? Having a cow go out and graze.
Yeah, you're not.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to. You don't need the energy to grow hooves. To
right.
grow, you know, you grow 20 pounds of leather. You don't need the,
right.
you know, and all the organs that are not used. You know, you don't have to take that energy out of the environment in order to produce the little bit of meat that you do use on a cow. So, absolutely, it's you know, all the energy goes straight into making exactly what it is you want. So, carbon footprint, and not just carbon. When cattle are terrible, and you know they're the gases that they produce, belching in,
right.
and from the other end is nothing but methane. And methane
right.
is like 10 times worse as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And so you know, again, this sort of thing's the way to go. And if you can engineer, you could also engineer it to be healthier for you too. Maybe you put in omega-3s. Instead of omega-6s and things like that into the.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, why wouldn't we replicate a nice grass-fed beef? Yeah, that has the proper balance of omega-6
fat,
and omega-3 instead of the skewing wildly off into omega-6, which all this feedlot beef does. Yeah, you'd have, you know, time was they would have said, well, you could make it low fat, and it's like nowadays you don't care as much about that. You say, well, could we get the right fat in there? That's the important
exactly.
thing. And instead of eating this fat we don't want to eat, can we eat the fat that we know is actually kind of good for us and that we should be eating? Yeah. So you know, between the environmental impact, ultimately economics and nutrition, I think that model really starts to take hold at some point. And the fact that they have cut the cost so drastically, does the article say? You know, is there any expectation for this to show up in some commercial venue anytime in the near future? I think we'll be seeing it before too long.
Oh yeah, and the article, I don't think it really gets into when we would see it, but you know, I would say if you've seen the price drop from $325,000 burger to $11 in this short of a period of time, then you may actually see this at some point. Dropping below the cost of feedlot animals,
right?
Because again, you're not having to pump as much energy into this process as you would the feedlot animal, and so you ultimately this ends up being cheaper too, and so you know, price of meat goes down. People that couldn't afford meat in the past will be able to add meat to their diet. And there's one other thing, Bill. I look at this also as a prerequisite technology to, setting up Mars colonies and things like that. We can't have herds of grazing cattle on Mars, but you sure do this. And, you know, when we had our guests on the show a few weeks back, that was one of the things she was not looking forward to if she were picked to go to Mars. Is that she'd have to convert to vegetarianism because
yeah.
she's currently
well, she was talking
meat.
About how much she would miss butter. Seems like
yeah.
vat-grown butter ought to be a fairly easy thing to
easier
to
than
meat,
meat
right?
I would imagine.
Yeah,
comparison
yeah.
to meat, it ought to be easier. So yeah, that's again, I'll put this up with 3D printing and other technologies as sort of prerequisite technologies for setting up colonies on another planet. You gotta have stuff like this.
Well, Stephen, we're essentially out of time, but there has been some validation further, I should say, additional validation for your observation from a few years back that in the future everything will be a coffee shop. Give us the quick 30-second take on that. What's happening there?
Well, you know, in that article I talked about how everything, you know, be able to do anything, you know, in a coffee shop, you know, and and that included getting an education. Well, Starbucks is partnering with the University of Arizona to offer, you know, college to its employees. And, you know, you work for Starbucks, they pay for your tuition. Now, this is online university, so I presume you pull out your laptop and, you know.
Yeah, once it's your break or, you know, you're done with your shift, you can
clock
just
out.
Switch
you
over.
You don't even have to go home. You just... Just go have a seat and order your own cup of Joe and get to work. And that's the literal coffee shopification of education right there. And I thought it was kind of a neat story there.
There you go. Starbucks leading the way to where we'll all be eventually, which is going to Starbucks to get our college education. Well, there you have it. Hey, I think did we cover all of our topics? I think we actually made it through.
We might have.
Made it through that entire list. That's pretty amazing. Well, Stephen, what then would be our music this evening?
California by Blackboard Jungle.
Blackboard Jungle. Hey, we've heard from them before recently, haven't we?
I think so.
Or am I imagining things? Anyway, sounds cool. California with Blackboard Jungle. Thank you, Stephen, for putting that together. Thank you all for listening in. We'll be back again next week with another brand new show. And until next time, live to see it.
Mother's wing. Yes, you were where the angels roam. Caught a tear in my dad's eye when I left home. Put my faith in a girl from a topless bar. On a clear night we lay and stare at the stars. So much about you that I hate. Put your hands around my throat so I gotta stay. A fresh young thing when I waved goodbye to everything. Sure was great, so glad to know ya. Lost myself in California. Still with the heart air you breathe. Another number in your black seas. That call home coming up for air. Will I ever find my way back home from here? One day I wrestle you to the ground. Slap in your face, try and touch me now. Then I'm just blowing in your wind. That's where all the end is, what you have been. Young thing, when I waved goodbye to everything, sure was great. So glad to know ya. Lost myself in California. Lost myself in California.